Good morning. May it please the court. Casey Granis, representing Ms. Merritt on appeal. I'll reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This prosecution is barred by the statute of limitations. The state failed to prove that it filed the information charging the mortgage fraud counts within the statute of limitations. The mortgage fraud statute contains its own special statute of limitations, and there's two alternatives within that statute. One, it requires that the information be filed within 5 years of the commission of the offenses. There's no dispute that the information here was not filed within 5 years of the commission. And then we turn to the other alternative in the statute, whether the information was filed within 3 years of the actual discovery of the violations. So what this case comes down to.
Do you consider that to be a jury question, the second prong?
Does it have to be a jury question?
No, do you consider it to be a jury question? Is the defendant entitled to have a jury decide that question?
It's a, generally, it's a question of fact. So whether it's a bench trial or a jury trial, the underlying facts for this, whether a statute of limitations has been complied with, is for the trier of fact.
So you would envision a criminal trial where, as part of the evidence in the criminal trial, what the prosecutor prosecuting the case knew and when the prosecutor knew it to be the subject of evidence?
Prosecution, including the law enforcement agents tasked with investigating the crime, that would be the salient testimony that would be presented, the evidence presented to the trier of fact on whether the prosecution complied with the statute of limitations in a given case.
What case do you think best stands for that proposition in the context of a discovery statute of limitations?
We have cases in the civil context.
Okay, those are different because those do not have a statute that says actual. No civil statute of limitations case that you've cited has a statute with the word actual.
That's correct. But then we look to statutes that are similar or analogous. I've cited the fraud statute, which doesn't contain the identical language of actual discovery, but its substance of that language is...
You have a criminal case with a discovery rule statute of limitations that adopts the position you advance anywhere in the country?
Gomez. The Ninth Circuit case is the closest, is a case where the federal court applied the discovery rule to statute of limitations in a criminal case. In that case, that involved the criminalization.
They hold that the state had to prove those facts in the trial. And that's the piece of your case that seems troubling, that you would have to prove that rather than raising it by a motion and having it resolved that way.
Well, it's possible that the facts are only susceptible to one interpretation, then that issue can be decided as a matter of law. So in that situation, it doesn't need to go to the jury. It could be decided as a matter of law. But otherwise, if the underlying facts are disputed, and at least, or it could lead to one, more than one conclusion of whether the statute of limitations was complied with, then it is for the trier of fact. And in a criminal case, it would go to the jury, or to, in a bench trial, the judge, obviously.
Aren't you then going to have a problem any time a defendant exercises a Fifth Amendment right, and the state's going to say, well, we didn't discover this because when we asked Mr. Jones about it, he asserted his right to remain silent. How are you going to deal with that in the context of a trial?
I hadn't considered that particular question.
Seems like a big problem.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, all these cases are going to be fact-specific, but... In that situation, the trial court would have to determine the admissibility of that fact. And whether it goes to the trier of fact or not, I don't know. I mean, the state could make the argument that, well, in this, when it comes to us having to prove the statute of limitations that was complied with, that's a fact that needs to be taken into account. And then the trial court could decide, okay, whether that gets to the trier of fact or not. In a bench trial, obviously, that's easier to deal with, which is what we have here.
Well, that's why I started with my question about who decides this, and you told me it's the trier of fact, so if the defendant wants a jury, the jury decides it.
Ultimately, yeah. Unless, again, the facts are susceptible to only one conclusion. I mean, in a case like Ms. Merritt's, for example, I mean, evidence was presented to the trier of fact. And then the question becomes, well, based on the evidence that was presented, did the state prove its case? I mean, in essence, this case is no different than any other criminal case where the statute of limitations argument is raised. We have jury cases where the state failed to prove that the charge was brought within the statute of limitations.
Those cases are cases where there's a defined period of time, so it's a much easier thing to both allege and prove or not prove.
Well, whether it's easier or not, I think it's important not to fall into this trap of letting the tail wag the dog, so to speak. I mean, we have this statute of limitations that needs to be applied in every criminal case involving mortgage fraud. So the question becomes, well, how do we do that? And
this case just strikes me as one where you should be careful what you ask for because of what may become admissible in front of the jury that really is going to prejudice the defendant's right to a fair trial on the merits.
Well, and in a given case, that's something to wrestle with. But Ms. Merritt's argument is that, look, the statute of limitations was not complied with. This is a bench trial. The question Your Honor is raising is certainly worthy of serious consideration, although it's not a factor in this particular case. And the relief Ms. Merritt seeks is the reversal on this. Thank you.
You have 4 minutes.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is David Seaver. I'm here on behalf of the State of Washington asking this Court to affirm Ms. Merritt's convictions. And I guess trying to follow up on the questions posed by the Court to Mr. Grannis, they all kind of presuppose the idea that that the timing of the filing of the information and whether it involved a raised an issue regarding the statute of limitations. That question, I think the Court's examination of Mr. Grannis presupposes that this was a subject that came up in the context of the trial itself, which was kind of where I was trying to go, although I apologize. I don't think I made it perfectly clear.
It came up before the judgment and sentence was signed, didn't it?
Correct, after the close of evidence, Your Honor.
Well, in a bench trial, is that too late?
I suppose if defense counsel had wanted to reopen testimony, but it does seem an odd situation if we're asking. There was no request made after the closing arguments were given to reopen the evidentiary phase of the trial. I suppose that could have happened, but it wasn't asked for.
How is this different than any post-trial motion where you say the evidence doesn't support the decision that was made, re-examine the evidence and apply the correct law and rule in our favor?
If there had been a request for further evidence to be taken.
What if their position is the state has to prove this, the state didn't prove it. Right. Here's the record before you already. We don't need any more evidence because it's a failure of proof argument.
And I think
that's their argument.
And I think that's what happened here was the Court ruled on this challenge to the statute of limitations period on the basis of the evidence that was presented at the trial. If there were additional information that needed to be considered, defense counsel didn't seek that, but the Court did rule that that the investigation, initially involved Mr. White, the co-defendant.
The Court orally ruled that, but there's no written finding in the findings, is there?
I don't believe so.
Is that necessary if it's an element?
I suppose the notion that the timeliness of the filing of the information is an element of the crime is a novel one to me. I've never seen a case that said that on point. We typically never prove that in any case.
You prove when something happened, and that's all that's needed. And what's odd is that this statute doesn't depend upon when the event occurred.
Right. I guess, Your Honor, when I was kind of pondering this question, we never, in our case in chief as prosecutors, at least in King County, we never offer into evidence the charging document and ask the jury, look at when this information was filed and decide whether that falls within the statute of limitations for this offense. We ask juries to consider all the elements of the substantive charge, but we never include within the to convict instruction, you also need to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the charging document was filed on this date and compare that to the date of the offense and then refer to the statute of limitations period and decide whether that fell within the requisite charging period. And if the legislature wanted to make that an element of the offense, they certainly could do that when they're writing the criminal code, and they never have. And that's why I cited to the court the cases from a number of other jurisdictions into an ALR article that discusses this in greater detail. I didn't want to attach a long string cite in my brief, but that most courts treat this as an affirmative defense, not as an element negator or an element of the crime that the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, but something that a defendant needs to raise. Because what it essentially does is say, the defendant says, whether I committed the crime or not, I get away with it because the state didn't charge me in time. So it's different than an element negator.
You say treat it as an affirmative defense. Are those criminal cases?
They are, Your Honor. The federal criminal cases are the ones I cite.
One of the differences between the civil and the criminal arena is that you can waive the statute of limitations in the civil area,
sure.
But generally, except in the context of a plea bargain, you don't waive the statute of limitations in a criminal case by not asserting it.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the cases that have examined that in this state, in Peltier and Stoudemire and, I want to say, Swaggerty, those were cases where there was no issue of fact that was debatable. We had a charging document with a date stamp that wasn't disputed, and we have the date of the offense. And just on the four corners of the charging document, you look at the statute of limitations, and there's clearly the charges were filed after the period had run. Where there is a factual dispute, as Mr. Grannis, I think, recognizes, a defendant's failure to assert that at trial when the evidence can be developed is a strong argument for considering that to be a target gone by on appeal, unless they can show that somehow, I think if defense can prove it through the evidence that was admitted at trial on appeal, then that's fine. But if they can't, it certainly seems like an affirmative defense that should have been raised at the proper opportunity and was neglected. There was one other point in reviewing my brief, I don't feel I discussed carefully enough. Judge Leach, you've already touched on the distinction between the civil statute and the criminal statute of limitations in this particular mortgage fraud statute. But I think there's a strong distinction to be drawn between the imposition of some kind of due diligence in a civil case and what happened here for a couple of reasons. One, the legislature hasn't sought to impose that due diligence standard on criminal actions, and the courts have not either. And the other thing that struck me is that, you know, in a civil action, typically what we're asking the party that is bringing the suit to prove that that they exercised due diligence, but that party was present during the events that resulted in the filing of a lawsuit. In other words, they were party to the event, and there might be a good reason.
Well, it's not always true. Where there's an argument about defective manufacture of a product, their party is perhaps present at the time of injury, but they don't know the process
sure.
necessarily led to the product failure or the reason for it.
Absolutely. In a defective manufacturing case, I think that might be distinguishable from a fraud case, which is what Mr. Grannis is suggesting be appropriate here, where there's a civil case of fraud. And there might be a reason to ask the party that's brought the suit, well, how hard were you, how skeptical were you during the transaction that you're now claiming was fraudulent, and how diligent were you in determining whether you'd been taken or not? This is an entirely different set of facts. I mean, the state, the police, obviously they weren't party to this loan closing and this appraisal process. And the investigation initially focused on Ms. Merritt's co-defendant, and it was only in the course of that investigation they discovered that Ms. Merritt was involved as well. And to suggest that the state and the police and the federal investigators were somehow acting without proper expediency in investigating the co-defendant, and that led to it. You start to go down a rabbit hole, and I can't really see how that would work in the context of a jury trial. I mean, asking a jury to make those decisions about whether the police acted expediently enough, it's hard to see how that would work. I don't really have anything in addition to add to what I wrote in my brief. If the court doesn't have any questions, I just yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on some of the questions and answers that have been given so far from Judge Leach regarding, well, if the issue does get to the trier of fact, you know, what are the implications for that in terms of what evidence is presented on that issue? One thing I'd like to emphasize is that when we're talking about statute of limitations, what the state needs to prove, compliance with that, there needs to be a uniform rule here. And there can't be one rule for when the case is tried to a jury and another one for when a case is tried to the bench. So whether in a given case there's some sticky evidentiary issues involved when it's presented to a jury, okay, that may be down the road a case like that happens. That's what we've wrestled with then.
What about counsel's point that criminal cases you don't see the prosecutor filing the information or presenting the information as an exhibit and having the jury find that the charge was filed within the requisite period of time required by the statute of limitations? Has that ever happened in your experience?
No, but it strikes me that when we're doing the statute of limitations, it's not necessary that the information itself be admitted into evidence and presented to the jury.
Have you ever seen a case where a jury was asked to decide that the timeliness, decide the question of the timeliness of the filing of the charge?
No, I don't think so, and that's what makes this case interesting, Your Honor. But what we do have are cases where the state...
Well, it might tell us something about the answer, too, Mike.
Well, that's true. But one thing I want to emphasize to this court is that when we're dealing with, say, let's look at it this way, a more garden variety, we'll call it, statute of limitations claim, where the issue is just more straightforwardly, okay, did the commission of the offense fall within the statute of limitations? So we looked at cases where I cite Dash, Novotny, cases like that. Cases where it was reversed on appeal because the state didn't approve that the given charge was filed or was that the offense was committed within
that
time.
The evidence presented to the jury didn't establish a precise enough date for the events that led to the conviction that they could have occurred outside of the applicable statute?
That's right. And again, my point without laboriously trying to reach here is that in cases like that, the information itself is not presented to the jury. It's that the underlying facts, though, are, and from that, we can draw the legal conclusion whether the statute of limitations was complied with.
If you're pointing us to the facts here, what facts show when the prosecutor or the investigating law enforcement agency knew enough to charge your client?
Well, we look through the whole course of the investigation. It starts with when the federal agent tasked with investigating this case learned of the fraudulent appraisal.
Why do we federal agent knowledge to state agents?
Because the state's relying on the federal agent's activities to bring this case.
Do you have a case where we've imputed the knowledge of the federal government to the state?
I haven't cited that case. I haven't looked for that case. The state hasn't made that argument, and that's why.
Well, you're making it now, and that's why I'm asking you the question.
No, I don't have that case, Your Honor. I'll look for it.
That seems to be a remarkable proposition that an independent government entity would have its knowledge imputed to state actors.
Well, I don't know how extraordinary that proposition is when you've got the state actor relying on that federal government investigator's activity to bring
but
the prosecution.
No control over that activity.
But the state does have control whether it brings the case or not, and
but
it's relying on the federal
us
actor.
That here that we should dismiss the charge because the federal agent didn't do her job quickly enough.
And when the state relies on what the federal agent did or didn't do, then that's on the state. And I will point out just briefly here that the federal agent did meet with the prosecuting attorney in this case before the statute of limitations ran out, and still the state didn't file within the limitations period.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.